Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, May 13th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble contributor Doreen Nicol speaks to Sarah Jama. Jama is the co-founder of the Disability Justice Network of Ontario. Through the Disability Justice Network, Jama has been challenging the Ontario government and its health services to move from policing people with disabilities to allowing them to have personal and political agency and to thrive within their communities. Nicol and Jama talk about the importance of accessible health services and creating a society where people are seen beyond their ability to produce. The pair also touch on Bill C-7 and the expansion to include mentally disabled people to apply for medically assisted deaths. Jama and Nicol also talk about abolishing private long-term care homes, continuing our conversation from last week. Sarah Jama is a community organizer based in Hamilton, Ontario. Her areas of community engagement include work for disability justice, anti-racism, feminism, and social justice-based movements and activism. Jama currently serves as the outreach coordinator at the Hamilton Center for Civic Inclusion and is co-founder of the Disability Justice Network of Ontario. Doreen Nicol is a social activist, freelance writer, and frequent contributor to Rabble.ca. In 2016, she won the Hamilton Independent Media Award for Social Justice and Human Rights. Here are Nicol and Jama in conversation. Take a listen.
Welcome to Rabble Radio, Sarah.
Hello.
Disability Justice Network of Ontario. That name, I think, says it all. Justice is exactly what's needed so people with physical or invisible disabilities are able to live in a world where they're free to be. As an activist, you challenge society's framing of disabilities in terms of economics and accessibility, whether that refers to someone's ability to be deemed productive and earn a living, or whether it involves their ability to execute their purchasing power in a store. So how can society move from policing people with disabilities to allowing them to have personal and political agency and to thrive within their communities?
I think that, you know, the goal of the Disability Justice Network of Ontario is to teach young disabled people to ask the questions, you know, where do we go when the services in place don't work for you? Oftentimes, disabled people are told to go to this service or that service and ask for help, but we're not taught that we have political agency and we can push to create the world that we want to live in. And so for us at DJ Noel, the first step is teaching young people how to build out a theory of change and act on it. Disabled people fit every race, religion, geographic location, but we're the largest minority in the world, but we're the most silent because we often struggle to see ourselves as political. And so that's the goal of DJ Noel. And to answer the question of how do we build a world where everybody can thrive, we need to be able to see people outside of their ability to produce. I think that disability justice is the antithesis to capitalism. If we can begin to build a world that isn't just focused on economics and my ability to produce, we can build a world that begins to fit everybody, and we can stop the warehousing of disabled people and the ways in which people who cannot work are discarded and thrown out of communities and society.
Recently, there were news reports that a 31-year-old Toronto woman with multiple chemical sensitivities, who also happens to use a wheelchair, was close to getting final approval for medically assisted death. She had asked for this because she was living on Ontario Disability Support payments. Those payments provide only $1,169 per month. In this case, the woman also received an additional $50 to help with dietary needs. Given the fact that the Ford government states no more than one-third of a person's monthly income should go to rent, that woman has a budget of $389 specifically for rent. But even using the full $1,219 that she gets from ODSP, it would be impossible to find housing that was wheelchair accessible and wouldn't worsen her chronic illness. Her application for medical assistance in dying, or MAID as it's known, stated abject poverty was the reason. Now, there's a lot to unpack here, and I've given a lot of information, but Sarah, could you help listeners understand how the Ontario government expects anyone to survive on just over $1,000 a month, and also the implications of this case for people living with disabilities?
This is something that the disability community across so-called Canada was ringing the alarm about a year ago. So a year ago, Bill C-7 was put on the table, and it was an expansion to medical assistance in dying. Prior to this, anybody who was terminally ill could apply for medical-assisted suicide. But then Bill C-7 sought to expand that for people who were disabled but who were not terminally ill. So it specifically targeted disabled people on the premise that because we are disabled, we are inherently suffering, and said that a form of treatment could be physician-assisted suicide that could be requested. And so many of us were saying, and testified at Senate and talked to as many MPs as we could, explaining that when you have a society that is legislating disabled people into poverty across the country, which means that in every single province, social assistance rates are legislated below the poverty line, you're creating situations where disabled people who can't work are forced to live in poverty. Healthcare is not universal. So in Ontario, for example, it takes 2 years of wait time to access a pain clinic. So if you're experiencing harm because you can't pay your rent, you can't afford food, and you can't access proper healthcare, it doesn't necessarily mean your disability is causing your suffering. Rather, it's the government's decisions to underfund and further push people into poverty who are disabled that is causing people to want to access medical assistance in dying. We are all pro-choice in life and in death, but when the government is choosing to fund one decision, so my access to death over my access to be able to pay rent and have food on the table and access proper healthcare, that is eugenics-based policy, right? And so everything that we were saying came true. You mentioned the one woman who is applying for MAID, and she's almost through her application process. Another woman was in the media a couple of weeks ago as well, who did access MAID. And the Senate has actually recently said that 200 people who were disabled but not terminally ill have access MAID already since the expansion, and that 35% of people since 2020 who have access MAID have done so because mainly they were worried about being a burden on their friends and family. So because disability is not funded and aging is the leading cause of disability, we've created an ableist society where people will age out of the workforce, they will eventually be disabled, and they're worried about being burdens on their family because you can't afford to be disabled in so-called Canada, so they're opting to kill themselves. What does that mean provincially? Well, the Ford government consistently has said over the last year and over the course of the pandemic that he wants to create programming to help disabled people get into the workforce. The truth of the matter is many disabled people just simply can't work, and the workforce is inherently disabling as well. And his move to push people into the workforce who can't work, and his continuation of privatizing our healthcare systems and privatizing long-term care homes, is continuing to uphold a system where, you know, profit is being made off of disabled bodies and people are continuing to be warehoused instead of supported on the basis of disability.
There are so many important issues that need addressing in Ontario. And the next one I wanted to talk about was long-term care, specifically private for-profit long-term care homes that house people in facilities that are understaffed even before COVID and often don't have enough food, incontinence products, or personal protection equipment. And again, we saw this prior to COVID. COVID just exacerbated the problem. In Ontario, 4,000 residents died from COVID. Across the country, 14,000 older disabled people died. You don't want the government to nationalize these institutions, Sarah. Instead, you are asking for the decarceration of long-term care. And you want to replace these facilities with communities where disabled elders and disabled people can thrive. How will the abolition of long-term care liberate disabled people and elders and end this ableist and ageist system that prioritizes profit over human lives?
That's a great question. Someone on our team, Megan Minton, who's out in Ottawa, has done so much research on the links between our carceral systems here in Ontario and across so-called Canada and long-term care. One of the things that she writes about, and it's also on the DJNA website under the Abolish Long-Term Care campaign link, is the fact that the prison systems in Ontario and our long-term care systems use the same food suppliers. So the same people that are preparing prison food are the same people preparing food in long-term care. Oftentimes people in long-term care homes don't have access to internet and proper phones. Many people are overstuffed in rooms. So you'll have situations where there are five or six people in rooms meant for two or three people. And this also happens in our shelter systems too. So these systems are linked in a way where if you are somebody who needs support, it's easy to take advantage of you. And that's what's happening to disabled people who end up in these long-term care homes. You are often stripped of your rights. You often are told where to go, what to do, what to wear, what time you're going to get your personal support. And many people would not be in long-term care homes right now if they were able to access proper funded home care and also palliative care, as well as assistive devices. All of these things are extremely underfunded. And what happens is, rather than funding home care and the ability for people to be able to live at home as disabled people, many people are forced to go into long-term care when they would simply be able to be at home if they could afford their needs, like personal support workers and medical supports. And so the demands from the Disability Justice Network of Ontario are to decarcerate disabled people, stop warehousing disabled people, and instead focus on funding home care and supports for disabled adults. There's more funding that goes into childhood disability across Canada than the lives of disabled people who are adults. And that's because disabled people are seen as a burden to society, a burden to the state. And these institutions, these long-term care homes, have been able to bring in so much profit, billions of dollars, on the backs of disabled people who need proper supports. We saw over the course of the pandemic, doorknobs being removed from people's rooms. We saw the case of Chris Gladders, who his family was in Hamilton, but he was laying in his feces for an urine for weeks at a time, and that's why he accessed medical assistance in dying. It was similar for the Truchon case in Quebec that actually pushed the creation of medical assistance in dying. He went to the Supreme Court and demanded access to MAID, even though he wasn't terminally ill, because he was that afraid to be in a long-term care home. And that's what's currently happening. It's the option of, like, I'd rather die before I end up in these institutions where I'm going to be abused. And these institutions have a historical linkage to, you know, abusive institutions of our past, like the Aurelius Island of the Idiots and the Feeble-Minded, where thousands of young children were disabled and who were physically, sexually, emotionally abused. And these institutions have existed in every single province and now exist in different forms, group homes that are underfunded, some long-term care homes where there have been issues of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse too. The answer to the long-term care crisis isn't to nationalize long-term care, which is what some people have been calling for. We see that in Quebec, for example, 90% of the long-term care homes there are actually publicly owned, publicly funded. They're not privatized. And yet they had some of the worst cases of COVID and some of the worst rates of harm that have come to disabled people in those institutions. And so we need to, instead of talking about nationalizing this system of harm, abolitionists need to be working together with disabled people to say, no, like, people shouldn't be locked away. People should be able to be in their communities and with family and not forced into these homes. Another example I can think of is Vicky Levac. She's out in Nova Scotia and she has the same disability as me, cerebral palsy, but to a different degree. And she moved out to Nova Scotia for school at 19 and was promised all these supports. She got there and she realized she couldn't access funding for the support she needed for her personal care. And so instead of being able to live alone, she was forced to live in a long-term care home. And she's been fighting. She's now 31 and she's been fighting for years to be able to access supports in her home as she should be able to be able to live, because she's able to take care of herself. She just needs personal support work, and that's her right, and it should be funded. And so people across the country who are disabled have been pushing for the decarceration of disabled people in these institutions for a long time. And I think COVID has shone a light in terms of the conditions in these places.
You've brought up another great point. Not everyone in long-term care facilities is old, and many of these people want to live on their own. I spoke with Natalie Mara last week from Ontario Health Coalition, and we were talking about the privatization of home care. And in the summer of 2020, Ford privatized the last parts of home care. He's introducing bidding, which we all know was a disaster under Mike Harris, and it drives down the wages of personal support workers instead of lifting them up. So I guess my question is, what do we need to do to improve pay for personal support workers to ensure that home care is not privatized and that people get what they need to stay in their homes?
I think progressives as a whole need to get better at talking about disability rights issues in so-called Canada. I think it's a shame that, you know, the most conversation that we're seeing publicly are about wages for personal support workers rather than the root cause of the issue of privatization and the issue of warehousing. We need to be working together across coalitions. You're right, it's not just seniors in long-term care, although that's the picture that the media has been painting for years. But many people who are disabled, who age out of the school system at 21 in Ontario, are forced into long-term care or into congregate care settings like group homes because there's simply no supports to keep families together at home. Like, people can't afford to stay at home and do the care work needed to keep communities together. And so we need to be building coalitions and talking about disability rights as the antithesis to capitalism and seeing that as like a root anchor in all of our movements. Disability justice is tied to prison abolition work. Disabled people are overrepresented in our prison systems too. It's tied to the push against privatization of our healthcare systems, and we need to be centering disabled people in these conversations. I think if we were to tell more stories from disabled people about the conditions in our hospital, about the medical ableism that people face, about ableism in our prison systems, and the ways in which ableism and carceral institutions are so linked, we would be able to paint a picture of how the most vulnerable in our communities are being left behind. But in almost every movement that I see, disabled people aren't being publicly represented and the mic isn't being passed. And I think that's a first step in terms of the fight. We need to be pushing against the privatization of our healthcare. And this is not a new thing. We've been ringing the alarm about this for years. It's only going to get worse unless we can make sure that this government isn't reelected. It's not to say that the Liberals or the NDP are any better. The NDP was also disappointing in their push to increase or raise the rates by 20%. That's still not enough to live on. Disabled people have been asking for the rates to be doubled. We need a basic income that doesn't take away from other social services. We need to make sure that under the Ontario Building Code, like, places of dwelling that are built are not only affordable, but are also accessible. That doesn't really get talked about. And so, yeah, these are all the things we need to be focusing on to make sure that we're building a world where disabled people can thrive.
Sarah, you also say that you've just alluded to the systems that hurt people with disabilities. So it includes the medical, educational, penal, and long-term care systems. They tend to tell people with disabilities what their rights are and how they should exist as a person with a disability. You identify and name the link between colonialism and ableism. In fact, your goal is to disrupt and dismantle colonialism and ableism, replacing them instead with accessibility, mutual aid, and restorative justice. Can you tell Rabble listeners how you're going to achieve this?
I think it starts from the ground up. It's not easy work. Ableism and colonialism and imperialism have always been linked. I think a lot of the conversations that we have around accessibility are stuck in like the early 90s, where we're talking about the meritocracy and people can work hard if we just open a door. We need to move past that and start talking about how war is disabling, work itself is disabling. The goal isn't to get everybody to work. The goal is to be able to like eat and to live, regardless of your ability to work. And so mass education is needed. We're right now trying to figure out collaborating with the Hamilton Wentworth District School Board to get into schools and start talking about this with young people who are disabled but sometimes don't know or don't identify as being disabled and don't see disability as a larger community that they can belong to. So I think education work is needed. The electoral system won't save us. Again and again, by all parties, disabled people have been failed. And so, yeah, figuring out mutual aid, how to support each other outside of these systems, outside of relying on the current systems too. And just, yeah, providing for each other, connecting with disabled people, finding out where they're at. Almost every movement work that anyone is doing, you can find disabled people there. For example, like most of the houseless people that I've met in Hamilton through work with the Hamilton and Cambridge Support Network have actually been disabled and are people who have been pushed out of the shelter systems because they're disabled, because they're seen as quote unquote disruptive, which is ableist language to say, you know, we don't have the services to support you, so you can't stay here. And yeah, just connecting with disabled people, including them in your movement spaces and asking yourself the question of like, how can we make sure to center not just productivity, not just wages, not just the workforce and access to the workforce, but more so how do we make sure we're taking care of each other and doing that mutual aid work and, you know, not asking the state to just focus on our employability.
I was talking to Kojo Dempsey, and I made the mistake of saying to Kojo, Sarah is everywhere. Why is that? It's because you are so involved. So what does the future hold for you, Sarah?
What does the future hold for me? I don't know, to be honest. The reason I'm involved in so many things that sometimes on the surface doesn't look connected is because it is connected. Like the climate crisis impacts disabled people. We saw that out in BC. Many disabled people were left behind to die in the heat waves. Or looking at, yeah, abolition work and how so many people who are disabled are incarcerated. Right now in the Barton Jail in Hamilton, there's dozens of people who have had their medication withheld from them. That's a form of punishment by the state. Or looking at what the Ford government has done and how they've treated disabled people and electoralism and the importance of harm reduction in that work too. Or the encampment crisis and the disabled people who are left behind there who can't find accessible, affordable housing. Like all of these issues are super hyper connected and impact disabled people the most, but it's not talked about in that way. And that's why I'm fascinated with like getting involved in as many different movements as possible. In terms of what the future holds for me, I don't know. I'm energized by, you know, talking to young people, people who are newly getting involved in different kinds of work and just supporting that. And we'll see what happens.
Thanks very much for coming in today, Sarah, and speaking with Rabble Radio.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate this.
That was Sarah Jama, co-founder of the Disability Justice Network of Ontario, in conversation with Doreen Nickel. If you'd like to learn more about Jama's work with the Disability Justice Network of Ontario, be sure to check out Nickel's piece on Rabble.ca this week. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to our editor of Rabble.ca, Nick Seabrook.
Thanks, Brianne. This week on the site, Rabble columnist Kathy Crowe kicked off our Nurses Week coverage with a call to action. This year, the third year of Nurses Week in a pandemic, it's perhaps time to pause the celebrations, she writes. With nurses being fired and program funding being cut, the best way to support nurses this nursing week is to advocate and organize. The Care Economy Group also shared a column with Rabble for Nurses Week on the need for a national labor plan to solve the nursing shortage. The crisis in healthcare in Canada has many dimensions, but the most obvious is the problem with labor shortages, the Care Economy Group writes. For years, researchers, advocacy groups, and various government commissions identified the need for a national healthcare labor force strategy. It isn't as though it is a puzzle about what to do. Ensuring an adequate supply of well-trained labor in any area does not just happen because it is needed. It needs to be planned. In Ontario news, this week it was uncovered that Ontario Education Minister Stephen Lecce participated in so-called slave auctions while at university. At Western University, Lecce was a member and eventual president of the Epsilon Omicron chapter of the Sigma Chi fraternity. During this time, the fraternity engaged in slave auctions where fraternity members would be auctioned off to new owners to be their slave for the day. Although Lecce has since apologized for his past behavior, one teachers' union says that the apology is not enough. A statement from the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario reads, "His participation in a slave auction fundraiser raises serious concerns about the minister's understanding of anti-Black racism and his ability to serve and support students, education workers, and families, particularly those who identify as Black." Premier Doug Ford said that he stood by his education minister and would not ask him to withdraw as a candidate in the 2022 provincial election. Finally, in international news, Common Frontiers, the Colombian Working Group, and the Canada-Colombia Solidarity Committee are organizing a delegation to accompany and report on the Colombian presidential election on May 29, 2022. Rabble is proud to be sending journalist Jace Tanner to report from the delegation. Stay tuned for video coverage, news, and analysis on the Colombian election in the weeks to come. Be sure to bookmark rabble.ca/Colombia Election 2022 to keep up to date on the news as it happens. You can catch all those stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. The last thing we'd like to share with you listeners is a reminder. Don't miss out. Our next Off the Hill event is happening this Tuesday, May 17th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4:30 p.m. Pacific. This month, our panel talks about the idea of a guaranteed livable basic income. What is it? How would it work? And how much would it cost us? Here to join that conversation is MP Leah Gazan, who in December of last year introduced Bill C-223, which, if passed, would establish the first national framework for an unconditional guaranteed livable basic income for everyone over 17 in Canada. Also joining us is Sheila Regier, co-chair of the Basic Income Canada Network. Carl Nirenberg, Rabble's senior parliamentary reporter, will also be joining us. You won't want to miss it. Register for that free event with the link in our description, or for all of you tuning in on radio, visit rabble.ca to learn more. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Nick Seabrook for his reporting this week, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.